So I got an email from Kathy Hazlett yesterday from Fairfield Cares, and it really sparked my interest to talk about this. We've discussed vaping and the concerns that we have, especially for our younger generation, for our high schoolers in particular. And when I was reading some of the information that came from this newsletter, I immediately thought we need to discuss this. It's called The Great American Vape Out, Resources to Quit. The Great American Smoke Out has been helping people quit nicotine and tobacco products for one day, the third Thursday of November to be precise, since 1977. And now there's an even bigger focus on not only quitting cigarette use, but really vaping and e-cigarettes. So joining us to discuss this, we have Kathy Hazlett back on the show with us. And we always love getting her perspective on the things that Fairfield Cares is focused on, but also understanding really something like vaping, for example, why it makes such an impact on our teens. Kathy is here now, the program director for the Fairfield Cares Community Coalition. Kathy, good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Melissa. It's great to be with you again. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm really glad to have you here. First of all, for people who are not familiar with the Great American Vape Out, as we just mentioned, it's been around for a very long time. And has it been successful, would you say?
Yeah, oh, definitely. Nicotine is one of the most addictive substances. And many people who are addicted to nicotine don't want to be. And so having this Great American Smoke Out, or as we're trying to start the Great American Vape Out, is to give people that incentive to just try it for a day, to go without nicotine or to cut down for that day. And sometimes that is just the motivation they need to keep going.
And I was reading here, actually, some of the results from the Fairfield 2023 Youth Survey. It indicated that fewer youth are vaping compared to the national data. So that's good. But we know, though, that vaping is trendy. It is something that teens are doing.
Yes, unfortunately, that is the case. And what we're seeing, or what we think we're seeing, is while the data is telling us that relatively few youth are vaping past 30 days in the past month, we do know that teens like to try, right? That's where the brain is kind of wired to experiment, to take risks. So maybe not everyone has tried vaping in the past 30 days, but over the past year, maybe they have. And so it's just really important to keep getting those messages out so teens are aware of, you know, what all those nasty chemicals in the vape devices are doing to their brain and to their bodies and to their overall health. And we do know, you know, with regard to messaging to teens, it doesn't work necessarily to be telling teens don't do this, because that's going to help them decide to try to do it, right? So it's about giving them information so that we respect the fact that they can make those decisions. And I think with parents also guiding them to say, you know, sweetie, it's really important to keep your body healthy, to keep your mind healthy. Vapes aren't going to do that.
Yeah, and again, we have Kathy Hazlett here, who is the program director for Fairfield Cares Community Coalition. It's so important that you're not afraid, Kathy, and I don't know if you agree with this, to speak up about this. I actually have my sister-in-law, who's in her 20s, and when she was in college, she too experimented with vaping. And I remember a few years back, she kind of poked fun because she's like, oh, you're so old, Melissa, you're so old. But I said to her, you really don't want to do that stuff. You really don't. Right. I said, you know, I know the flavors. I know it's kind of a fun social thing. You think you're kind of doing hookah or whatever. You think it's a fun social thing, but you don't want to touch it. It's addictive. It's not good for you. The reason that vaping was created, Kathy, correct me if I'm wrong, was really to help people get off of cigarette addiction, correct?
Well, that's what companies, that was their main marketing ploy. But the reality is, it's just another way of putting nicotine and a bunch of toxins into the body. And the reality is that many of the vape devices have more nicotine than regular cigarettes. So what's really concerning from a youth substance prevention coalition perspective is that these fruity flavors are simply getting our kids addicted to a substance that's going to be even harder for them to quit down the road. So we just don't want them to start at all.
It also took like a shift because, like you said, Kathy, the initial idea of vaping was to help. That's what they claim. These companies claim to help people get off of cigarettes. But it has shifted focus completely. I mean, when you look at flavors like bubblegum and whatever, that is specifically, I'm sorry, targeting preteens and teenagers to want to try this and to make it sound like this is really not that dangerous. I don't see people in their 50s and 60s trying to quit smoking going, gee, I'd love some bubblegum vaping. They're just not doing that. I think the focus has really changed. And I think even on a national level, they have tried really hard to ban a lot of these flavored vaping products and things like that. But in the meantime, like you said, just mandating, telling people you can't do it, sometimes will make people do it anyways. So what are resources to help teens quit vaping?
Yeah, so there are actually three, and we have them in our newsletter. It's Ditch Vape to a text number, and I'll bring up that text number. Ditch Vape to 88709, and that's the Truth Initiative's tech support, because we know that a lot of teens, you know, they're into texting, and so that's how they get a lot of their information, via social media, via their phones. So every day they can get a text message just to keep them motivated to support them in their quit attempt. Connecticut also has a new texting service. It's Vape Free CT to the same 88709. So you're not going to get the Truth Initiative, but you're going to get directed to the Connecticut Quit resource. That's a text service for youth. And then another really good online resource is teen.smokefree.gov/quit vaping, or just teen.smokefree.gov, and then you'll get to the information. Lots of really good information and resources on that online service as well. So I would say those are the three main ones. And then we're very fortunate that in our schools, we've got our drug and alcohol counselors, Tim Morris at Ludlow and Pam Walker at Ward. And then there are other, you know, social workers who are trained in helping to help teens quit vaping at other schools. So there are resources, and it's about, you know, helping teens realize this is something you really don't want to do. Mm-hmm. And we were fortunate toward the end of the last school year, we had eight teens from Fairfield's private and public schools involved in a vaping video project, and they developed 5 prevention vaping videos with the theme of Don't Start Now. And those can be found on our website. We're really excited. We've shared them with the schools as a way of, here, health teachers, put this in your curriculum and show these to the teens, because this is a wonderful way of getting some peer-to-peer messaging to say, hey, even your friends are saying, don't do this. There isn't any benefit from vaping.
Mm-hmm. And I do want to remind folks that Fairfield Cares has more resources available, as well as some strategies that they got from Truth Initiative on how you can deal with cravings, for example, if you are coming off of vaping or nicotine products. You can go to their website, FairfieldCaresCT.com. Again, FairfieldCaresCT.com. And Kathy, I want to thank you so much for highlighting this. Instead of the smoke out, we are really focusing, I should say, on the Great American Vape Out. For our teens and our young adults. So thank you so much.
You bet. Thank you, Melissa.
All right. And have a happy Thanksgiving. We'll talk soon.
Likewise. Take care. Bye-bye.
All right. Kathy Haslett again, who is the program director for Fairfield Cares Community Coalition. And you can always get more information if you want to learn more at Fairfield Cares CT online. So make sure you check them out. Earlier this month, we revealed that data of more than 100,000 Connecticut patients was stolen in a cyber attack on hospitals in Waterbury, Manchester, and Vernon, Connecticut. That attack on Prospect Medical Holdings over the summer crippled operations at those three hospitals, and it resulted in data being stolen, including patient addresses, dates of birth, diagnosis and treatment plans, lab results, and financial information. So how do we avoid something like this happening again in the future? Cybersecurity expert on The Morning Show, Vahid Bezadon, is back with us. He's also an assistant professor of data science at the University of New Haven. Vahid, welcome. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. I'm doing very well. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. 3% of Connecticut residents impacted by this cyber attack, Vahid. What happened? This isn't the first time we've heard about hospital systems in particular being attacked by cyber criminals.
So the attack that occurred in August targeted a number of hospitals and healthcare providers supervised by Prospect Medical. Initially, it was reported that only 63 Connecticut patients were affected, along with 24,000 employees. And by that, I mean the information and the personally identifiable data of 63 Connecticut patients and 24,000 employees were breached. But recently, Prospect Medical released a new piece of information. The number is much higher. Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, it's 110,000 Connecticut residents.
It's a lot of people.
Who've had their personal data compromised during a 6-week cyber attack. So the cyber attack was going on for 6 whole weeks before it was discovered and hopefully stopped.
Doesn't feel too good to be a Connecticut resident when you hear something like that. I mean, what in the world is going on, Vahid, with hospitals in particular? You and I have talked about this before, where these cyber attacks are so common here and across the country.
Well, that's unfortunately true. Medical data, healthcare data, and so on are of high value in the black market of breached or compromised data exchange. So hospitals are commonly targeted, medical practices are commonly targeted. In many cases, the compromised information includes not only information such as social security numbers and biographical information, but also medical diagnosis, the medication you are on, your visits, the private medical information that you typically don't want to be publicly available, or you don't even want to share with people outside your closest circle. So this information can be leveraged by malicious actors to, at the very basic level, to target you with a customized advertisement or marketing, and at the worst level, through blackmailing patients whose data has been exposed, or if you're talking about the darkest possible outcome, medical diagnosis and medication can be weaponized towards assassination as well. I don't want to follow the very nice, kind, positive call that you just had before me with a dark story, but unfortunately, the risk here is very high.
Well, and I have to say, Vahid, I think that the big question is going to be, patients are between a rock and a hard place, right? Because it's not like you can go to a hospital and say, hey, you know what? I heard about that breach over the summer. I don't feel comfortable giving you my information. You can't do that. So what can
you do?
That's
very true.
Right? What do you do to protect yourself?
Well, there's a strategic move that every one of us can make. We can speak to our representatives as well as the state attorney's office and make sure that they put in place regulation that improves the cybersecurity posture of healthcare providers here in the state. And at the same time, we want to make sure that those who've managed to compromise the Prospect Medical patients' data, don't get away with it. This needs to be both a preventative as well as a prosecutorial pincer move to make sure that the incentives in compromising cyber healthcare data are decreased, and at the same time, the risks are increased for those malicious actors looking to get access to our private medical data. Other than that, the Prospect Medical letter to patients whose data was compromised includes an offer of automated identity monitoring, as well as a few tips on what affected patients can do, including monitoring their healthcare providers' statements and contacting relevant providers immediately if they see services that they did not receive. So unfortunately, there isn't much that the affected patients can do about this. It's mostly aftercare. There isn't much that can be done at this point. The genie is out of the bottle. It's just
right.
Very hard to put it back in.
It seems like, Vahid, really it comes down to investing in cybersecurity. It seems like more times than I can count, hospitals are reactive. I don't know if they have, if they're investing in having their systems checked and having a cybersecurity expert to go through. And we know this for even other businesses, not just hospital systems, but you know you could get more bang for your buck with a hospital system. But people don't invest in having a cybersecurity expert come through and make sure that their systems are secure. Would you agree?
Well,
or is that not really the issue?
This is a strange fact of life. HIPAA, the federal regulation on healthcare information privacy, it's one of the most rigorous acts about data privacy at both federal and state level.
Oh, so you can't even really have a cybersecurity person do it because of HIPAA.
Oh, actually, you have to have cybersecurity people do it because of HIPAA.
So why don't
all
they?
Hospitals? Now, there are different levels of investment.
Okay.
Maintaining an eye out, keeping a constant eye on what's going on in your network from a cybersecurity perspective, making sure that everything looks normal, nothing's out of the ordinary, is part of what needs to be done at healthcare providers to ensure cybersecurity. Unfortunately, many healthcare providers, both at the level of private practices all the way up to hospitals, don't see that as a major need. They may outsource it to a generic cybersecurity consultancy or contractor who might look at the network events or system events every week or every month. Or they might even have an in-house person whose job is to take care of cybersecurity while also taking care of other IT needs. But there needs to be a dedicated cybersecurity unit inside hospitals whose job is to make sure that cybersecurity breaches, such as what happened at Prospect Medical Hospitals, don't occur again.
I agree.
There needs to be constant vigilance.
That needs to be an investment. I think when you talk about the state putting pressure on our hospital systems, I think that has to be an investment that hospitals make. Because, sure, you could say it's not going to happen to me, but that's just being careless. I just think that's taking a risk that is unnecessary. It's like having health insurance. You know, is it possible that you'll land in the hospital for, you know, months and you'll need that health insurance? But probably not if you're a healthy individual. But that's why you buy health insurance, because you have to have that in case of the risk. And I feel like I don't know why we wouldn't invest in that for all of our hospital systems, why we wouldn't have a dedicated cybersecurity expert checking on that. I think when you look at the 3% of Connecticut's population saying all of our stuff was compromised and I'm not happy about that, and my hands are sort of tied because I had to go to the hospital, pretty sure they probably hope they had a cybersecurity guy. I'm thinking they probably are hoping that now, but it's too late. So I don't know.
Yeah, that's very true. Typically and classically, cybersecurity is seen as an overhead, something that needs to be taken care of, but is not part of
is not essential.
The core operation.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And that view should change.
That's crazy.
You're definitely going to be targeted. Regardless of what your business is, you are going to be targeted.
Okay, I want to switch gears really quickly from cybersecurity to artificial intelligence because this is a major national story. OpenAI, which was the creator of ChatGPT, they got rid of their CEO, Sam Altman. And now nearly all of the employees, over 700 employees at OpenAI, are threatened to quit unless they bring Sam Altman back. Now, Microsoft, which supports OpenAI, they've already hired Sam Altman, and they're like, yeah, you know what? If anybody wants to quit, you guys can come work for us at Microsoft. What in the world is happening, Vahid? What is going on?
Oh, it's like an episode of Succession.
Right?
It's been a weird weekend. Starting from Friday, we started hearing news from OpenAI that Sam Altman was let go by the board. The board issued a statement that was not typical. These statements are usually written in good faith with a kinder language, but the statement released by the board at OpenAI stated that Sam Altman has not been truthful, has not been honest in his communications with the board, and that is the main reason for his firing. And that was immediately followed by Greg Brockman, Sam Altman's lieutenant, essentially, at OpenAI, resigning from his post at OpenAI. And then during the weekend, strange things started to brew. First of all, there was a lot of speculation over what could have been the cause of this. There are rumors, and these are first-person rumors from my colleagues inside OpenAI, who believe that this was a coup organized by Ilya Sutskever, who's OpenAI's chief scientist and a brilliant researcher in AI, who had disagreements with Sam Altman over matters surrounding AI safety. Sutskever believes that AI safety should be the core mission of the company. And just to give you a little bit of a history, OpenAI started as a nonprofit to work on AI safety, mm-hmm. to work on what they call artificial general intelligence safety. And over the years, it also started a for-profit organization within the nonprofit who then became the OpenAI that we know today, the one that charges users for ChatGPT Plus
right.
and the code that's written on top of it. So it started as an AI safety company. Today, about 20% of the company resources are dedicated to AI safety. So there seems to be a bit of disagreement or a struggle going on in the company, and that may have been the chief cause of the coup.
I mean, with all the confusion, though, only because we're running out of time, Vahid, what does this mean for people who use platforms like ChatGPT? With Sam Altman at least sort of in limbo, he's gone right now as of the time that we're talking, and now 700-plus employees saying, we're going to jump ship from OpenAI if you don't bring him back. What does that mean for users of ChatGPT?
So, Melissa, ChatGPT is a very strong large language model, a very strong AI chatbot. But at the same time, there are many other competitors to ChatGPT. If the people who created ChatGPT go and work in other companies working and developing similar AI, be it Microsoft or Google or Hugging Face and so on, at the end of the day, we are still in the age of Cambrian explosion in AI.
What does that mean?
Instead of one ChatGPT, we already have a large number of competitors for ChatGPT, which are mostly open source, which are mostly free to use if you have the infrastructure to run it.
It
means that the technology is not going to go away.
Okay.
It's only going to be more diversified.
Interesting.
It's not necessarily bad news for the consumers.
Do you think OpenAI is going to bring Sam Altman back?
I don't think Sam would want to go back. Maybe they'd rebrand and restart OpenAI under a new flag.
Mm.
But from what it appears, Sam has already settled at his new role in Microsoft.
Interesting.
So we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, we certainly will. Vahid, I always love getting your perspective on some of these stories. Thank you so much, and I hope you have a fantastic holiday. We'll talk soon.
Always a pleasure, and same to you.
Thank you. Vahid Bezadon, again, is our cybersecurity expert here on The Morning Show, but he's also the assistant professor of data science at the University of New Haven.
Family, relationships, and personal growth. Professional counselor Julius Dudix is here to help. Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Everybody has a grateful heart on Thanksgiving, right? It's a season of giving. We love each other. How do we keep a grateful heart, though, throughout the year? How do we take the lessons and what Thanksgiving is all about and apply it to our everyday lives? Well, thankfully, we have a counselor who could help us out with that a little bit. We've got Julius Dudix back on the show with us just before the Thanksgiving holiday. Hey, Julius, how are you?
Hi, Melissa. Thanks for having me back. Yeah, I mean, I love gratitude. I love Thanksgiving. It's probably my favorite holiday because there's so much to be thankful for. There's so much good. And you know, a lot of times we see what we look for in life. And if you look for the good, you're going to see the good. But if you look for Hamas, if you look for ISIS, if you look for sickness, if you look for the bad, you're going to see the bad, the negativity. So really what I'm talking about is a mind shift. Mm-hmm. We have to really train our brains to think differently so we feel differently and we behave differently. But it starts with that thinking, and I call it cognitive restructuring, thinking, getting that gratitude, the ability to be thankful for things is so mentally healthy.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, Julius, let's just talk about the idea of being grateful. Why can't people naturally be grateful? Why is that a skill we have to work on? It's not really natural. Even at the young age of being a toddler, we naturally want more and more when we go into a store. It's not something we naturally have as humans.
Yeah, we are born selfish. It's all about me, 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 me. And the truth is that selfish people, people who are arrogant, people who need admiration or approval, those kinds of people, it's very hard for them to really focus on the good and to express the gratitude that is so mentally healthy. Sometimes we can't feel grateful because our emotions have been numbed out. And a lot of times that deals with trauma, and a lot of times it's childhood trauma or abuse from a caregiver or witnessing horrific events. But trauma causes to feel shock. But then you have the question, am I going to focus on the shock? Am I going to focus on the trauma, or am I going to focus on the good? And again, as I said, you know, a lot of times it's we see what we look for in life. And so you've got to train your brain to not focus. As difficult as it is, as painful as it is, Melissa, I always say to people, a thankful heart, it doesn't deny the problems. It just shifts the focus.
It does. It absolutely does. I mean, and you just kind of highlighted some common barriers people face when it comes to expressing gratitude or why they are not naturally grateful. But we do know that, I think you had just mentioned it before, Julius, that there are a lot of benefits to practicing gratitude on an everyday basis. I mean, can you talk a little bit more about that so people can really understand the impacts of a grateful heart?
Oh, man, I'll tell you, you wake up in the morning and you either say, good morning, God, or good God, it's morning.
Oh, that's so true. Talk about perspective. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. I love that.
Yeah, it's crazy because the benefits of gratitude, you know, you're happier when you focus on the good. You're more optimistic. Even, Melissa, your immune system. Stress is a known killer of white blood cells, and white blood cells are those things that kind of help our immune system fight off sickness and so forth. That's why a lot of people who carry anxiety, they get sick quicker because in terms of their body chemistry, the white blood cells are being killed off.
Mm.
So it gives you a sense of connectedness to other people. Your endorphins, serotonin, dopamine levels increase. You get better sleep even when you focus on the good and all the good that you have in life. But again, it's that thinking, that shift in focus that you really have to say to yourself, why can't I? What's preventing me from being a positive Perry as opposed to a negative Nelly kind of a thing?
Mm. And I mean, so again, we have our morning show counselor, Julius Dudix, here, and we're talking about gratitude and how to practice it. I mean, what are some ways that we could begin to practice gratitude even after the turkey has been eaten and we've taken that nice nap that tends to happen right after a big meal? What do we do the Friday after Thanksgiving and then for days to come after that?
Yeah, you got to slow yourself down. And you know, you can't focus on crazy Aunt Tilly or crazy Uncle Fred over there, but you got to focus on the moment, and you almost have to you know, practice the mindfulness at a Thanksgiving table and just slow yourself down. Mm-hmm. And don't just grab everything, eat quick, and then go watch football and fall asleep. You know, that's slow yourself down. And then I always encourage people, you know, when you are thankful, you know, a lot of times people have a hard time with it because they feel like, oh, man, it's too gushy, gushy, mushy. You know, who wants to be thankful on, you know, I don't want to do that. You know, slow yourself down. Look into the eyes of your spouse or your significant other or your child or whatever. Look into their eyes. Slow down and just say, hey, thank you for the help you've given me this year, or thank you for whatever, you fill it in. But you want to slow down and look through the eyes of the other person and really connect in terms of vibing with that person and say, hey, thank you. You could write a note, a thank you note. You know, you can keep a journal. You could just slow yourself down and give to a meaningful cause. Maybe find a cause you like to give to, and you could practice it that way. But the whole idea, again, is to think differently so you feel better and then you behave better.
Mm. And it also really helps with, again, with anxiety, especially if you're going into Thanksgiving where you're a little worried about what is going to be brought up around the Thanksgiving table. Or maybe there are personalities even in your family that you just don't mesh well with. And every year at this time, hey, you sort of dread seeing that person. I love my in-laws. I really do. I lucked out. But my husband and I, the whole drive every other year when we go up to Massachusetts, we know politics are going to be discussed. It's inevitable. My husband's uncle is a cop. He's a sergeant for the Worcester Police Department, and he is incredibly passionate about politics. So I know it's going to come up. And because I work in the news, man, I get roped into some conversations sometimes, and I just kind of plead the fifth a little bit. I just sort of just chill there and let people kind of spew off, because I do that even on this show. I just don't really share my opinion on anything. And when I do, I feel like most people agree with it. It's not very controversial. It's true, Julius. Did we ever go over this in therapy? I don't really share my opinion, like, especially with family. I just sort of let people talk. Well,
I don't know. I
professionally have to do that. So I figure in real life, why don't I do the same thing? But I do think, Julius, this is, interestingly enough, this is probably one of the most high anxiety, I would say, stress-induced dinner table events of the calendar year for people. Wouldn't
you
agree?
You are so right. And the problem is the expectation. Because, you know, we've seen Hallmark movies and we've seen all types of you know, It's a Wonderful Life and everything. And you expect
that's a thing of the past. And that's the past, I should say. And that's also super scripted because, man, I'm not seeing any Hallmark movies recently at Thanksgiving dinner tables. Not across the nation. I don't think so.
You know, you almost with difficult people, you expect it. E-X-P-E-C-T. Expect it and accept it. A-C-C-E-P-T. How do you accept it? Well, you don't give them power. You tell yourself, no matter what they say about Donald Trump or no matter what they say about this or that, I am not going to get upset. I'm just not going to give my power away. But also, I just spoke to a couple recently, Melissa, and they're on the verge of divorce. And I said, guys, let's do a holiday truce. Let's just declare a holiday truce. And a holiday truce means that I'm going to put aside my differences and focus on family and focus on the good in each other. And I'm going to focus on the kids and so forth. And I'm just going to not let those issues surface. So we're going to put them on the back burner in a holiday truce. And that's how the Thanksgiving table can be a little better. Sometimes you just have to gently ignore and you have to, you know, listen to your own biorhythms. And if you feel yourself getting upset, just smile, nod. You know, there's power in that, because if a person sees you getting upset, then they have the power over you. But if you can smile and gently smile and just kind of, you know, move around, walk to another room or whatever, or change subject. But you, above all, Melissa, you've got to stay focused on the good. Remember the good. That's what Thanksgiving is all about. Mm. It's not so much, I think there's a difference between being thankful and giving thanks, because giving thanks focuses on the object, but being thankful focuses on the giver of the object. And that's the real meaning of Thanksgiving, you know?
How do you express going back to the stress of the Thanksgiving table, for example? How do you express? So this is not my own example, because I truly, you know, I really don't have this issue with my in-laws or with my family. So I'm very lucky. But I do know of people who I mean, they literally dread this holiday. And you know, and we talk about this each and every year, you and I do. But I'm curious, how do people kind of rise above? So, yeah, you don't let people take the power from you. I get that. But how do you show your best version of yourself? How do you still love a person who it seems is unlovable?
Yeah, yeah. You really, what you want to do is focus on the truth. The truth is that they're broken. The truth is that you're broken. I'm broken. Everybody's broken. And the bottom line is, when you focus on that truth, then you say, okay, God, give me the strength to show your love to other people. And the bottom line is, there is a wonderful, powerful, great, gracious God of the universe who created us for relationship with him and who wants relationship with us. But we as humans tend to get sidetracked. So to ask him, get on your knees in the morning and just say, God, give me wisdom and give me the grace to be able to know what to say, how to say, when to say, not to overreact, and almost let go and let God do the work in your life. Mm. And when you do that, I believe, Melissa, that power, that love overwhelms you. And you just feel better. You feel connected spiritually to a God who loves you incredibly. And when you do that, you just have that wisdom and the ability to love the unlovable and almost do what Jesus did. Love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Not love what they do, but love who they are.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we all have that.
Yeah, it brings about a sense of peace, Julius, when you can take a step back. You know, like you and I talk a lot about looking in the mirror. And I think if we're being honest with ourselves, maybe we're not to the extreme of somebody that you have to sit around the table with at Thanksgiving, or maybe you have better social skills, or maybe you're better at reading the room than somebody else. But there are things that we're not good at, because we're imperfect. You know, at the core of it, we are imperfect people and we just don't do everything right. So when you can mentally take a step back and go, hey, you know, maybe I'm better behaved at the Thanksgiving table, but, you know, I fall short here and yet I'm not persecuted for it. Should I be persecuting somebody because of what they're not great at, which is being respectful around the table or not hurting people's feelings or taking things too far? Just having that mentality brings such a sense of peace. And I have found with myself, it takes down my anxiety in social situations. Like when I think to myself, well, I'm pretty imperfect. I can't even imagine what people think about me in X, Y, or Z situations. So who am I to judge somebody just because maybe I do know how to handle myself, conduct myself properly at the Thanksgiving table, but this person doesn't, for example. I don't know.
Sure.
It's a nice way of bringing peace to yourself as well.
Yeah, yeah. And people are striving for happiness and stuff. It's not the happiness that brings the gratitude. It's the gratitude that brings the happiness. Mm. And when you can look at yourself and say, I'm broken, then it helps you to see that other people are broken. And maybe I'm not going to be as judgmental or critical or negative when they say something really off the wall. And sometimes you just got to use humor, Melissa. Oh, there goes crazy Aunt Tilly again. You don't say it out loud, but you're saying it in your head, you
right.
know. There goes crazy Uncle Frank, you know, doing his crazy thing.
Well, and that's something else that I learned, I think, with working with you, is that you have to set reasonable expectations. You know, mm-hmm. like the people who show up each and every year and go, oh, man, hopefully this isn't the year that blah, blah, blah drinks too much or blah, blah, blah acts out
right.
or blah, blah, blah doesn't go on a political rant. But if history repeats itself, if things are consistent, if people are who they are, why yep. do we get ourselves disappointed and all riled up and upset about things that we already have the facts in front of us? We just don't want to accept that. You know
right.
what I'm saying? Like, it's
That's
so true, though.
Yeah.
Right, it's true. Like, because I was yeah. that person, Julius. I look at, yeah. there's somebody in my life who I grew up with, and I adore this man. I adore this individual. I'll say it. It's my older brother, because he knows. But, you know, something
okay.
that I really struggled with growing up, especially in my college years, was I would say, you know, I feel like he doesn't want to talk to me. Why is it I always have to call him? Why do I always have to call him? Why do I have to make the effort? Yada, yada, yada. And yeah. I will never forget, I can't remember, it was probably my mother or it was probably my pastor. I don't know. One of the people I go to about everything. And they're like, but when has your brother ever picked up the phone and called you? When has your brother ever mm-hmm. initiated anything? And my brother's a really good guy. He's a great guy. And I love him. But it would yeah. bother me because I had these expectations that never lined up with the facts that were in front of me. I kept waiting for my brother to change and
yeah.
pick up the phone
yeah.
and be like, hey, you know what? I've realized I want to call my sister. It was just not going to happen. And so
mm-hmm.
the last 10 years of my life have been bliss because I know if I want to talk to my brother and I call, he's going to pick up the phone. It's great.
Yeah.
But I'm not
right.
waiting for that phone call.
It's not, right. so
unless his house is burning down,
thinking.
I'm never going to. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
You have to shift your thinking.
It's the expectation of knowing that, hey, this is the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get to a place of what is within my power to control. Well, the only thing that's within my power to control is my attitude toward my brother.
There you go.
And if
yeah.
I love the idea that if it's possible, as much as it depends upon you, live in peace. As much as it depends, it may not be possible
mm-hmm.
to be at peace with everybody. But you know, we all want that peace. It's up to us to really get that internal peace, because you
yeah.
certainly can't control the storm, but you certainly can control your actions and attitudes within the storm.
Sure.
And so
yeah.
you really want to go into the season with a positive, especially I've dealt with recently blended families, broken
mm.
families, where you know it becomes all about the children then.
Mm.
And as a husband and a wife who are separated, need to really focus on the needs of the kids and really develop some holiday traditions and maybe watch the Macy's Day Parade or maybe, you know, make pumpkin bread together or do something that, you know, is going to be healthy and happy for the kids to carry on from generation to generation to generation.
Yeah, that's a good
point. But above all, teach them to understand the power and the love of God at Thanksgiving, because he's the source of everything. And we focus on that, we just feel better mentally.
Well, Julius, I hope that beyond just Thanksgiving, people can practice gratitude. And if people need your help with this, what is your website?
Yeah, you can go to njcc.online or call the office at 203-243-7714.
Julius, you have a happy Thanksgiving with your beautiful family, and we'll talk after the holiday.
Thank you for all you do, Melissa. You keep at it.
All right. Thank you so much. Julius Dudix here on WICC.
Melissa in the Morning talks with career strategist and workplace expert Julie Bauke. It's Julie on the Job. Now on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
I say this as just a question I get sometimes from you, the listener, other times from people in this industry. What's your next move, Melissa? What's your next move? You know, what happens after you're done with Melissa in the Morning? And I'm like, I don't even know what I'm having for lunch today. But one of the things I get asked about a lot is, would I ever become a news director? Would I ever become a program director? And immediately, that's a hard no for me. It's a hard no for me. And the reason I say that is really not because of what the job requires, because I can sometimes be a little bossy. I feel like I would be okay as a manager. I have a nice balance there. But it's more of, I don't want to sign my soul to the devil. What do I mean by that? It's more important that when my shift is done, when this show ends at 10 o'clock each weekday morning, Other than a couple of emails here and there, that means I get to have my life. I can't say the same thing for managers, though. Julie Bauke is here, and we're diving into what a new survey is looking at in regards to this and people determining whether or not being a manager is right for them, especially if they want to grow in their careers, but maybe that promotion's not part of the equation for them. Hey, Julie, how are you?
Good morning. Yeah, so you're just like two-thirds of Gen Z and millennials surveyed said, no, thank you.
Yeah.
When it comes to taking on a managerial role.
Mm-hmm.
And this has companies concerned, as it should. But if you really think about it, even if you just take a look at all the things you and I have been talking about, it should be an obvious, it's an obvious result. It's an obvious next, you know, conclusion from all the data we're reading, which is younger people, and I'm just going to say Gen X millennials, care more about
and quality
of
life.
The phrase quality of life. Let's just call it quality of life overall.
And
they look at their manager and go, yeah, no, thanks.
That's literally what I agree, though. And here's the thing is I love my PD. OK, I think he does an excellent job. But, man, I don't want to be him. And it's not because of him as a person. I just think to myself, man, this guy literally there's not enough hours in the day for him. And you couldn't pay me to want to do his job. I'm sorry. I don't want to do it.
Right.
Nope.
Yeah. When you look at what there was a lot, there was another couple articles out within the last couple of months talking about how middle managers, let's just call them leaders, let's just call VP and up leaders, everybody in the middle, managers, and everybody else individual contributors. So it's like a big smush sandwich.
Mm.
The senior leaders are pushing down, saying, get this done, meet these goals. And the individual contributors are saying, they're saying, you know, I'm trying to also have a life here.
Right.
And by the way, you laid off half the department. And now you expect me to pick up the rest?
There
really?
It is. That's the other part of it, Julie Bauke. So because our company did go through this, and this is public news, obviously, because we're a corporation that we're local, but people obviously know we're in the media, so you're going to know this. But in 2020, we went through some major financial hardships because of the pandemic. And so we laid off a lot of our staff. And we really, while we have built it up a bit, we've taken on a lot more roles than we did before. I mean, this morning show alone is a great example of that. It used to be a two-person show. It still is a one-person show. I mean, thank God for my board op and producer, Eric, who like fills in the gaps when need be. But this was always at least a two, if not three-person talk show in the mornings. It's still a one-person show. So what I'm getting at is even at our PD level, my PD is also a jock on one of our stations. He's the PD of another station. This guy has his hands in 700, it seems like, different roles. It just has become where most companies kind of are like, hey, you know what? You could do it, and we've seen you do it, and so you're going to stay at it. And I will say, there are people who love it. Like this is my PD's life. He loves it. He loves the roles he's got, and God bless him. But for me, I actually would find his role to be very exciting, intriguing, creative. It's very like it's stuff that I would love to do, but not at the expense of having a little me time, family time, not work time. So is there a way, Julie, that you could strike a balance, especially if most people in my age group are going, yeah, no, I won't take the promotion, even if it means a pay raise. You can't incentivize me to sell my soul to the devil. Like, is there a way to strike a balance?
You know, I think that the problem is, so that's a very complex question. So when you look at, let's say you're sitting there, you've got a department, there's a layoff, whatever, or somebody leaves and they're not replaced. Now you're asked to do more with less. Here's what happens. And I have talked to those people for years who've been in this situation who it's like, well, your best people get most of the stuff dumped on them because they always find a way to get it done. But at what cost? And that's the issue, is that when you're really good, you get more and more and more, and there generally is not near enough recognition for that in whatever form recognition might take here. But and so then your good people end up getting burnt out saying, you're not appreciating me, I'm doing a job and a half or two jobs, and so I'm out of here. And so the turnover, the pressure to keep it going And if you're one of those people who's like an overachiever, like type A, like go, 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 you will sacrifice your health, your sleep, your relationships to get done what's asked of you and without asking. And then you hit a wall. You get sick. You know, I mean, something happens. And so the first thing that an individual has to do is figure out their boundaries. And you say, you know, I need a little me time. So if you were my client, I'd say, let's pretend that you'd been asked to take on a bigger role there. And you'd say, you know, I'm really worried it's going to consume my life. And I'd say, okay, let's talk about that. When you say you need some me time, what does that look like? Does that mean you need to go to yoga twice a week at 7 o'clock in the morning? Does it mean that you need to be available 3 nights a week for family things? What does that mean? And so, like everything I do, it starts from a place of, what do you want? What are your non-negotiables? And once you figure out what those are, and then there's the stuff that you are willing to give on, it's okay to go to your boss and say, can we carve out a role? I get that we're strapped here and we need somebody to do these things that aren't getting done anymore. I'm willing to take on this, but here are here are my boundaries. And you have to get agreement, get it in writing, and get an increase for it. Because if they're not filling roles, they're saving money. And so to just keep piling it on the people who aren't pushing back is just a terrible way to lead. It's a terrible way for your people to live. And so you set those boundaries, you drive the conversation, and you say what you're willing to take on, and then hold firm.
So it's an interesting conversation, how you determine if being a manager is right for you and can you grow your career without getting promoted. We're going to continue the conversation with Julie next, because what I want to talk about is how unfortunate it is that younger workers don't want to become managers, because that used to be sort of a goal for a lot of people. And so I'm wondering, you know, again, if, you know, going back to, is there something that we could do to strike a compromise? Have we just become as a society all about instant gratification and you have to check your email 23 out of the 24 hours a day? Like, have we made it so that managing is, it looks different than what it was even 10, 15 years ago because of technology and what have you? It's not just me, actually. When you look at younger workers, many of them are drawing a fine line between their jobs and their personal lives. In fact, about 2/3 of people surveyed recently from one of these national surveys, it looked at full-time employees and whether or not they would want to become at the manager level. Would they want to be promoted to that manager level? And 2/3 of them said, yeah, no, I'm all set. I'm good. Okay. And the reason being is because they feel like they're giving up an awful lot just to make a little bit more money or have some more vacation time or what have you. Julie, here's my question. We have Julie Bauke here, our career strategist. I think it's kind of sad, to be honest, because I can remember myself being, you know, in high school and saying I would like to make, you know, great money and I'd love to be a leader. And these are some of the skills that I actually feel like I naturally could be very good at. But as I've gotten older and my priorities changed, I got married, I had a child, I have to focus on mental health, especially working in the news. I realized that I'm like, oh, less is more. I'm good. I'm good where I'm sort of at, and I don't know if I could see myself going to a leadership role in the sense of being a manager ever. And I want to know when that changed and why that so severely changed, because like I said, in a matter of 15, 20 years, that was not the mentality of younger workers. You were always trying to rise to the top.
Well, you know, also younger workers have seen how their parents were treated in the workforce. They just don't see the ladder as their only option for, you know, for a career. You
That's
know,
interesting.
We used to, when you think about, you know, back in the 80s when I started working, it was expected that everyone would want to climb the ladder. If you didn't, there was something wrong with you. You weren't ambitious. And so ambition was only defined one way, straight up. And there are certain companies that had sort of an up or out policy. If you weren't moving up, there wasn't value necessarily in you staying in an individual contributor role. and you need to move on. But I think we have to take a look at what we consider leadership. So, for instance, there are people who have people reporting to them. They've got the title. They have direct reports. There are people who are leaders because they're an expert in something. People come to them for guidance or expertise on something that they understand deeply. Then there are people who lead by influence. They don't necessarily have the title, but they have the respect of the organization, and they're just good role models. And so we can lead in different ways, and it doesn't always have to be about having people report to you. And also, let's not forget that we are still in this huge push for work from home or work from remote work, hybrid work, flexible work. Let's just call it that. And the side that wants flexible work is going to win. And so doesn't that then, if you've got remote workers who are doing their jobs, and let's just assume the best here for a minute, why do you need people who are, in essence, at that point, babysitters? So I think there's been a real concern with people who are in middle management is, am I going to be relevant moving forward? And so I think sometimes we get into management and our only skill is making sure other people do their jobs. And that's not necessarily marketable. So there's a lot that goes into this. And it's not just that people aren't ambitious. It's just they define ambition in a different way than previous generations did.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Well, Julie, you definitely gave us a lot to think about and some pretty, those are some pretty alarming findings with this new survey. But at the same time, I guess it makes a lot of sense after you and I kind of dive into it this morning. So thank you so much.
You're welcome. Have a great week.
Thank you.
Happy
you
Thanksgiving.
Too. Happy Thanksgiving to you, too. We are very thankful for Julie Bauke. That's for sure. I speak for all the WICC listeners. What would we do without our career strategist, Julie Bauke? For Julie on the Job, I'm Melissa in the Morning.